thanking the Fields Institute and Ken Davidson for having organized this event and for having invited me. I would also like to thank my department head, Professor Gauri Sankaran, for having come all the way from Montreal to be here today. I really appreciate it. I would also like to register my great indebtedness to my wonderful collaborators on the work that I will be talking about today. So I'll be talking about some work I've been involved in over the past 4 years, and my collaborators are Felix Finster, he's now got a chair at the University of Regensburg, Joel Smoller, and Shintung Yao. Okay, so this is going to be a talk about sort of mathematical problems in general relativity, and I thought that it would be appropriate to begin with a sort of brief reminder of the essentials that surround the mathematical formulation of the Einstein field equations. So in general relativity, all coordinate space-times in all coordinate systems in space-time are treated on an equal footing. So geometrically, this is expressed by the fact that space-time is a differentiable manifold. And general relativity is also a relativistic theory of gravitation, meaning that in the tangent space at each point of space-time, we have a inner product of Minkowskian signature, which enables us to measure the space-time velocities of moving objects. And in particular, at each point, we have a null cone that labels the possible space-time directions that can be taken by a light ray propagating through that point. And the dynamics of test particles in general relativity is formulated very geometrically. Namely, a massive test particle will move along a what's called a time-like geodesic in that space-like manifold. Time-like means that the tangent vector along this geodesic lies inside the light cone. So the space-time, the velocity of that test particle is less than the speed of light. And the limiting case corresponds to null geodesics. So these are geodesics which are everywhere tangent to the null cone. And these correspond to the space-time trajectories, or the world lines of light rays. Now, Einstein's tremendous insight was to realize that the effect of the gravitational field, which is going to affect the behavior of neighboring geodesics, should be naturally formulated through the curvature of this underlying metric, pseudo-Riemannian metric G. Now, curvature is, the analytic expression of curvature arises when you look at a one-parameter family of geodesics, and you're interested in seeing what's the equation that governs the evolution of the connecting vector between two neighboring geodesics on your manifold. And there is a classical equation known as the Jacobi equation, which tells you essentially that the second derivative, second order rate of change of that connecting vector, is governed by a linear equation which involves, in the right-hand side, the Riemann curvature of the metric. So the curvature is going to affect the behavior of neighboring geodesics. If sectional curvature is positive or negative, these geodesics are going to be focusing or diverging. Now, the actual field equations that govern the interaction of gravity with external fields were first written down by Einstein in 1915. These are known as the Einstein field equations of gravitation. And here is their analytic expression. I mean, the details are not so important. What is important is that in the left-hand side of the equation, you have a geometric quantity, a tensor, constructed from the Riemannian curvature, and which has zero divergence, in this case, in our case, as a consequence of the Bianchi identities. In the right-hand side of the Einstein equations, you have a term which describes geometrically and locally the energy and matter distribution of the source which interacts with the gravitational field. This is known as the energy momentum tensor. And whatever the field equations are for this field which is interacting with gravity, as a consequence of these field equations, that tensor will also have zero divergence. So you have the equality between two zero divergence tensors, one which has zero divergence for geometric reasons, namely the Bianchi identities, and another one which has zero divergence by virtue of field equations that govern the these external fields. Now these equations are, so for example, the equations governing the interaction of gravity with electromagnetism, these are known as the Einstein-Maxwell equations. I've written them here. In the left-hand side, you have the so-called Ricci curvature of the metric. In the right-hand side, the Fij is a two-form, which represents the electromagnetic field. And Maxwell's equations, which are written here, guarantee that this tensor has zero divergence. Of course, this is highly coupled because in order to solve Maxwell's equations, you need to know the Levi-Civita connection of the metric. You need to know how to parallel transport vectors along curves. But in order to know the Levi-Civita connection of the metric, well, you need to have solved these equations. So everything is horribly coupled. You've got the Einstein equations, which couple the metric to the electromagnetic field, which itself is coupled to the metric through the presence of the Levi-Civita connection here. Okay? This geometric curvature, Ricci curvature tensor, is quite complicated. It's basically, it involves, well, it's linear in the second derivatives of the metric, but it's quadratic in the first derivative. So this is these field equations are quasi-linear system of quasi-linear second-order PDEs for the 10 components of the metric and the 6 components of the electromagnetic field. Okay. Sure. I'll do that. So I'll leave these here on the board. So the problem is not so much to solve these equations explicitly. In fact, if you go to the library, you will find catalogs filled with thousands of exact solutions of these equations. And the real challenge for mathematicians interested in general relativity is to find solutions which describe ultimately the dynamical behavior of systems which are of interest in physics, and in particular in the study of very massive stellar objects. So objects where the gravitational field is going to be very intense and general relativity will be applicable. So the problem I would like to say a few words about is one of the fundamental problems in the field, which is that of finding solutions of these equations which describe the gravitational collapse of a mass distribution. So from classical work of Chandrasekhar and Oppenheimer and Snyder, it's known that if you have a star which is sufficiently massive, of the order of 2.5 times the mass of the Sun, once that star will have exhausted its nuclear fuel, gravity will become the predominant force, and the star will start collapsing under the attractive effect of gravity. So in this diagram, you have to think of time as running in the vertical direction, and you have to think of these circular cross-sections as representing the surface of the star which is collapsing. And general relativity makes some very startling qualitative predictions on what's going to happen. Namely, from the work of Penrose and others, we know that at some stage in the collapse, the gravitational field will become so strong that they will form what's called a closed trap surface. So this is a compact, space-like, two-dimensional surface which has the property that the pencil of non-geodesics which are orthogonal to its boundary is going to be everywhere focusing. So curvature is so strong that non-geodesics are going to be focusing in every direction. And the general singularity theorems predict that at some stage in the future evolution, you will see the formation of what's called an event horizon. So I've drawn qualitatively what the event horizon means. This means that this is a null three-dimensional hypersurface which acts as a natural boundary for the null geodesics which lie within it. So null geodesics cannot cross the event horizon in this direction. And also space-time, the space-time manifold is going to become singular in an essential way. In technical terms, what happens is that space-time becomes geodesically incomplete in all causal directions. And it cannot be embedded into a geodesically complete larger space-time manifold. Now, this is a qualitative diagram, but to this day, we know very, very little about the exact analytical processes which lead to this type of behavior. What we know, however, what we have known for a long time, is what the final asymptotic equilibrium configuration should be. So we know what will happen if you let time get very, 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 very large in this process. This is one of the most beautiful and, I think, you know, aesthetically satisfying results in this whole subject. This is the famous black hole uniqueness theorem, which has the names of Brandon Carter and Werner Israel associated to it. So what this theorem says is that if you have a space-time manifold which corresponds to what the asymptotic equilibrium configuration of this collapsing system should be. So in precise terms, it should be time-orientable, causal, stationary, at least at sufficiently large distances, axisymmetric, so there should be a little bit of rotation left, and weakly asymptotically simple means that it should correspond to an isolated system. So asymptotically, space-time should look like flat space. Then, with a natural topological assumption about the outer region of space-time, namely this outer region having being homeomorphic to R2 cross S2, and this boundary, this event horizon, being homeomorphic to R cross S2, then the Einstein-Maxwell equations have essentially a unique solution. Like it's a three-parameter family of solutions which are admitted to this problem. So in some sense, it's a boundary value problem that you're solving. The precise statement is that this other region admits a global chart. So T runs from minus to plus infinity. R is bounded by R1. I will tell you what R1 is in a moment. Theta and phi range over the usual coordinates, in which the metric takes the following form. The precise form is not so important. What is important is simply the parameter count. So how many parameters do we have in here? Well, we have, in fact, we can count them over here. We have three parameters, one which corresponds to the mass of the black hole measured from infinity, one parameter which corresponds to the angular momentum of the black hole in this equilibrium configuration, and Q, third parameter, which corresponds to the electric charge. So in some sense, the Einstein field equations have tremendous simplicity, I mean, give an answer of tremendous simplicity. I mean, you have very, very complicated system of PDEs, but the geometric assumptions about axisymmetry and stationarity, asymptotic flatness, the topology of the boundary and the topology of the outer region shrink the set of admissible solutions to a three-parameter family. What's very interesting is that this three-parameter family of solutions had been discovered, I mean, years before, but the discovery goes back to 1963 by Roy Kerr. Okay, so actually it was a really bold conjecture to make that this should be the only solution, and it took a long time for people working in the field to come to terms with the fact that this could indeed be the only parameterized family of solutions to this boundary value problem. Okay, so what about this parameter R1? You see, I have some inequalities on the ranges of my parameters. This inequality here says that the angular momentum and the charge of the black hole cannot be too large relative to the total mass measured from infinity. So this means that this function delta, which appears as a denominator here in the metric, it's a quadratic polynomial with two distinct real roots. The larger of the two roots is the lower bound in the admissible range of the coordinates over here. And the event horizon, so this boundary that I had drawn in my qualitative picture, is precisely the hypersurface R equals R1 asymptotically. So, I mean, this is a theorem about the asymptotic equilibrium configuration. What can we say about the dynamical process which leads to this equilibrium configuration? So can we prove some theorems on, can we set up a good initial value problem which will exhibit this type of dynamics corresponding to gravitational collapse? Well, by far the most fundamental and the best work done in this subject is work of Demetrios Christodoulou, formerly at Princeton and now at the ETH. And Christodoulou looked at the problem of the formation of black holes and singularities in gravitational collapse in the case in which the gravitational field is coupled to a massless scalar field. So the first question that you can ask is, well, why do you need to couple gravity to anything if you're looking at this type of situation? Well, this is because of a classical theorem proved by George David Birkhoff, Birkhoff Sr., who proved that if you're looking at a spherically symmetric solution of the Einstein equations, then the only solution of the Einstein equations which is spherically symmetric and which behaves reasonably at infinity is the Schwarzschild solution, which is a stationary solution by itself. So spherical symmetry plus conditions at infinity tell you that there is no dynamics taking place. So if you want dynamics and spherical symmetry, you have to pay a price, and the price is that you need to couple gravity to an external field. And Christodoulou, being smart, he chose the simplest possible field you could think of, which is a massless scalar field. Why does he take it to be massless? You'll see that in a moment. It's because he is going to set up initial data on a null geodesic cone. So he's going to exploit the conformal invariance of the massless scalar field equation in a significant way. So what's the statement of Christodoulou's theorem? So in his collapse theorem, I mean, this is sort of the simplest of all the collapse theorems that he proved. I mean, there are more recent ones which are much more elaborate, but I think this one is good enough for the purposes of today's talk. So you consider in these coordinates, the hypersurfaces U equals constant are future-pointing null geodesic cones. And the initial data with the assumption of spherical symmetry boiled down to specifying one function on the null geodesic cone whose apex is at the center of symmetry for the action of the isometry group. Okay? So there is this one function M of R, and the cross sections of the cone on which R is a constant are topologically two spheres. So I've drawn these two spheres by little circles over here. And Christodoulou's theorem says that if this mass function grows sufficiently fast compared to the radius or the areas of these two spheres, then indeed a trapped region will form and you will have a apparent horizon bounding a singularity. So the precise analytical formulation is as follows. You want the growth of M, this mass function as a function of the area of this sphere, to be at least, you want it to grow at least as fast as that. Okay? Now, I mean, this is a convenient lower, it's a convenient way of writing the estimate. I mean, I've taken Christodoulou's estimate and I've massaged it quite a bit to bring it to this form. The original theorem is a bit more complicated.
Okay.
But essentially what it says is that if the growth is sufficiently strong, then indeed this trapped region will form. I mean, I'm just going to flash this diagram by in front of your eyes. I mean, the professionals will recognize what this means. This is not so important. What's really beautiful, though, in his result is that he actually gets a sharp lower bound on the rate at which the curvature is going to diverge as you approach the singularity. So, for example, the simplest scalar that you can construct out of the curvature tensor, so the norm squared of the curvature tensor, is going to diverge at least as fast as 1 over r to the sixth. So his theorem is quite quantitative. And basically the only exact theorems that we know about the dynamics of gravitational collapse are in this vein. We deal with the spherically symmetric case. We know absolutely nothing so far about the general axisymmetric case. Okay. So this deals with the existence of singular solutions, solutions that develop singularities. But what about the existence of regular solutions? I mean, it's not an unreasonable question to ask. I mean, in the previous example, we looked at the coupling of gravity to electromagnetism. This is an abelian gauge theory. It's not unreasonable to ask the question of knowing whether once gravity gets coupled to a non-abelian gauge field, whether the nonlinearities in the Yang-Mills equations can somehow create a compensating process that will prevent the formation of a singularity. So this problem was first looked at numerically by Robert Bartnik, who was a former student of Yao, and Bartnik showed, quote-unquote, on the basis of numerical evidence, that indeed, when you take the so-called Einstein-Yang-Mills equations, so this is the case in which you couple gravity to a non-abelian gauge field, where the gauge field is an SU2-valued connection, then numerically, he showed that localized, everywhere regular solutions of the Einstein-Yang-Mills equations exist. So numerically, the evidence indicates that indeed there should be a compensating mechanism where the attractive force of gravity and the repulsive effect of the Yang-Mills interaction compensate for each other so as to prevent singularity formation. Actually, it took quite a while for this to be proved rigorously. This was done in a, I would say, how shall I use, what qualifier shall I use? I mean, in a masterly and formidable paper by Smoller, Wasserman, Yao, and Bryce McLeod. And what they proved is that under the assumption of spherical symmetry, the Einstein-Yang-Mills equations admit global, so everywhere defined, regular, spherically symmetric, and static solutions. In fact, I didn't say this in the statement of the theorem, but these solutions are actually localized. So asymptotically, the solutions are flat. Very quickly, just to give you an idea of the complexity of this problem, let me show you what boundary value problem these people had to deal with. So if you choose an appropriate gauge and massage the field equations, this is the boundary value problem that you have to come to terms with. So, you see, in the gauge that I have chosen, I'm essentially left with one function in my Yang-Mills connection form, W of R. Everything is spherically symmetric. I have two metric functions, T and A, to play with. These nonlinear ODEs represent the Einstein-Yang-Mills equations, and the boundary conditions that I need to satisfy to have finite mass, asymptotic flatness and regularity at the origin are the following. So you can study these things numerically, but I mean, what's absolutely extraordinary is that these people proved rigorously the existence of global solutions. And everything is governed, actually, by the concavity of W at zero. So once you normalize the equation sufficiently, you need to do a very, very fine estimate. Basically, if W double prime at zero is not too large, then the solution will exist. That's what essentially they have to do. Okay, enough of that. Sure. No, there's nothing dissipative at all. It's just the two things that are interacting together. No dissipation at all. Okay. Now, what about the case in which you go back to an abelian gauge field, so to electromagnetism, but you bring in the extra ingredient of a Dirac field, so the quantum mechanical, a classical quantum mechanical field, so the solutions of an equation which, if you start with compactly supported or L2 initial data, solutions which will have the tendency to spread out over time. So how does gravity interact with the coupling of a spin 1/2 field and an electromagnetic field? We know that if the spin 1/2 field is not here, if this equation is gone and psi is zero, from my previous uniqueness theorem, we know that the solutions are necessarily singular. They develop a singularity over time. Could it be that this extra ingredient of a Dirac field coupled to an electromagnetic field is good enough to give rise to regular solutions? And the answer is yes, provided that the mass of the fermion is not too large. So there is a limiting mass for which regular, like the previous case, global regular spherically symmetric solutions will exist. And beyond this mass, these solutions cease to exist in the sense that psi is no longer square integrable. It's no longer L2. Okay. The technique of proof is very, very similar, and I won't say too much about it. I mean, my own involvement in this research program was to try to see if any of these existence or non-existence results for equilibrium solutions could be understood dynamically. And in particular, I was also interested in seeing if we could dispense with the assumption of spherical symmetry and look at the effect of angular momentum in these solutions. Because you remember the black hole uniqueness theorem gives rise to three parameters, one being the mass, the other one being the charge, the third one being the angular momentum. So typically, you don't have spherical symmetry in the equilibrium configuration, but you only have axial symmetry. Now, you know, I mean, the mathematicians know that once you drop spherical symmetry, the equations become a lot more complicated. And it's actually quite remarkable that you can even prove anything in the axisymmetric case. But there are a few things that one can do. So let me present you with a couple of theorems which I will try to comment on. So the first result concerns simply the existence of L2 solutions which are time periodic. So we go back to this axisymmetric Kerr-Newman metric, and we look at a spinner field, spin 1/2 field, which interacts with the gravitational field and the electromagnetic field through the Dirac operator expressed in that geometry. So the first theorem, which is which one can prove, is that if you're looking at time-periodic L2 solutions, then the only solution that's allowed is the trivial solution. So there are no time-periodic solutions of the Dirac equation in this Kerr-Newman geometry. And this is a statement I'm saying here in the maximal analytic extension. So these are, I'm allowing my L2 solutions to be quite singular. These are solutions which can even be supported across the event horizon. So these are solutions, even in the distributional sense, they won't exist. What about the Cauchy problem? So what about the actual dynamical version of this result? So the first theorem that I would like to talk about is the following. So we look now at the initial value problem, the Cauchy problem, for the Dirac operator in this Kern-Newman geometry. So here I'm the Cauchy data that I'm working with are not quite as general as the ones that I dealt with in the case of time-periodic solutions. I'm assuming that the Cauchy data are supported outside the event horizon and that they have a that they're locally bounded near the event horizon, but always L2. Okay. Then the theorem is the following. So this quantity here is what's called the Dirac current. And it's a natural conserved quantity associated to the Dirac equation. It's supposed to represent pointwise the probability of finding the fermion or the spin one half particle at that position of space at that instant of time. So you look at the contribution of the Dirac current over any compact spatial region. So just to make things simple, I took this compact region to be an annular region. So T is fixed. K delta R is the annular region which lies between R1 plus delta and capital R. So remember, R equals R1 is the event horizon. That's the boundary of the external region. Okay. And the theorem says that for any choice, so no matter what the size of that annular region is going to be, asymptotically, the contribution to the Dirac current coming from that region will be zero. So asymptotically, what's happening, if you want qualitatively, is that the spin one half particle, if you let your clock run sufficiently late, will either escape to infinity or cross the event horizon, and it will be absorbed by the black hole. So I've drawn this. I've tried to draw this a bit differently. So this region K delta R is really a compact subset of a space-like hypersurface on which T equals constant. You integrate the Dirac current over that compact region and then look at the asymptotic behavior of that integral. And in fact, locally uniformly in the size of that annular region, the limit will always be zero. So next, well, you would like to know if you can get estimates on the rate at which this Dirac current, or pointwise, the solutions of the Dirac equation are going to decay. This is actually a very interesting problem because when we started working on this, we had what we thought were convincing arguments for arguing that things should decay faster than in the absence of an external gravitational field. And we also had convincing arguments, heuristic arguments, to argue that the decay should be slower. And in this case, it's really the analysis that gave us the correct answer. So everything is governed by the energy spectrum, or if you prefer, the Fourier transform, the time Fourier transform of the initial data. Okay? If you're in flat space, if you look at the Dirac equation in flat space, for obvious reasons which are obvious to people who know a little bit about the Dirac equation, there is what's called a mass gap in the energy spectrum of the allowable Cauchy data. So the Fourier transform of the initial data cannot, I mean, the support of the Fourier transform has to lie outside this, has to be contained in the union of minus infinity to minus m, or plus m to plus infinity. otherwise your mass would not be a real number. However, the space-time curvature, when you look at the Dirac equation in this geometry, has the very interesting effect of blurring this mass gap. So you can have Cauchy data which are supported non-trivially inside this interval. In fact, I'll show you a little graph that illustrates this. Let me put it over there. So in Minkowski space, so in the absence of a gravitational field, I've just drawn half the graph, this region here is forbidden. And for any admissible initial data, the behavior asymptotically as omega gets close to m from above, it has to behave like square root of omega minus m. However, in the background geometry of this rotating black hole, the space-time curvature allows for support, for the Fourier transform to be supported. But what happens, because of the behavior of the curvature tensor, is that this Fourier transform is going to oscillate a lot as you approach omega equals m. And so to work out what the rate of decay should be, you need to add up these oscillations intelligently. So you need to estimate the behavior of the Fourier transform. Okay? And this is what we've done. So the result is as follows. In the generic case, if the Fourier transform of the initial data has non-trivial support near either omega equals plus m or omega equals minus m, then the sharp rate of decay is in t to the power minus 5/6. Plus an error that you can estimate. I'm going to get to that. In flat space, the rate, as it turns out, is faster. So in flat space, I was going to show this to you. It's a little exercise that one can give in a good first course on PDEs. You can work out the rate in flat space, and the rate is in 1 over t to the 3 halves. So what is happening here is that basically, you know, the gravitational field of this black hole, which is very, very, very strong, is causing this Dirac spin 1/2 particle to linger a bit longer in any region of space before either escaping to infinity or getting absorbed. And the fact that it lingers longer is reflected by the slower rate of decay of the solution. So, you know, if gravity, which is attractive, the wave function wants to spread out, the two compete, the wave function wins, but it pays a price. And the price is exactly in the difference between this rate of decay and the rate of decay that your students work out in flat space. Yes. No, absolutely. The only assumption I make is the assumption that I wrote before on my Cauchy data. That's all I'm assuming. Nothing more. Okay? Nothing more than that. So there is, it's quite general. L2 has to be L2, and it must be locally bounded near the event horizon. Nothing more. Well, I've got, my time is almost out. I think that the real, I mean, holy grail in this problem is to see if you can prove similar type of results on the decay of wave equations in black hole geometries, but not so much in the case of spin 1/2 fields, but rather in the case of gravitational waves. I mean, this is the fundamental problem of the stability of black holes. And so I didn't say anything about the proof here, but I mean, the problem is different because, you know, gravitational waves satisfy a true wave equation. So there is no, you don't have that problem of a mass gap to deal with. However, the problem that you have with the case of gravitational waves is that the equations that govern these gravitational waves do not derive from any kind of natural variational principle. So you need to develop completely ad hoc techniques to handle this. This is currently being worked on by my colleagues and myself. So I think I'll stop here. Thank you very much. Well, the no black holes is the result about the existence of regular solutions. But this is, I don't understand it as a dissipative effect. I really don't. Well, this is the coupling constant between the non-abelian gauge field and the gravitational field. That's right. That's right. In fact, that's a regular solution, exactly. Yes. So, if you want to take one message home from the talk that I gave today, is that if you're interested in regular, if you're interested in regular solutions, then Dirac fields are no good for you. They're not good enough to create a compensating mechanism that will prevent the formation of singularities. Exactly. That's right. You need something else. So you need something which is more fundamentally nonlinear than Maxwell's equations or a Dirac field that's been painted on top of that. Exactly. And the SU2 value non-abelian gauge field gives one example of a mechanism where this happens.
So what is the final thought? Are
there black holes? Definitely, there are black holes and they're stable. That's the most important thing. You remember this picture with the event horizon. This is, very beautiful geometry. You've got incoming gravitational waves. Well, the event horizon is going to be strongly perturbed. It may disappear. It's going to change topology. The message from my talk is that asymptotically, everything's going to come back so the configuration is going to remain stable. This Kerr-Newman black hole, so the equilibrium configuration that I talked about, which I drew like this symbolically. So if you've got any kind of incoming radiation, let it be given by a spin 1/2 field or a Maxwell field or a gravitational field. Eventually, as t tends to infinity, asymptotically, you'll go back to the original configuration. So the singularity will prevail. The only case in which the singularity disappears asymptotically is the case in which, that we know of so far, is the case in which the gravitational field gets coupled to a non-abelian gauge field. And those are the solutions discovered by Smoller and Yao and Wasserman and MacLeod. Oh, physicists, they definitely believe that black holes are stable. Absolutely. But they would like to know, for example, at what rate the gravitational waves, so what's the rate of decay of these gravitational waves? And the type of result that I presented today is not for a gravitational wave, it's for the classical solutions of a spin 1/2 equation. Finally, the type of result that I presented today gives you precise analytical information on the rate of decay. You know what the rate has to be. Generically, for generic initial value, initial data, the rate is 1 over t to the 5/6, for example. And that's a very good question. There are experiments being carried out. Strictly mathematical. There are experiments are being carried out right now. I mean, this famous LIGO project is aimed at trying to measure gravitational radiation. And, you know, hopefully either, you know, the mathematical result will prove to be in reasonable accordance with the experimental data or not. So in either case, you win. Either means that you're doing good mathematics, or it means that you have to go back to your to the mathematical formulation of the problem and change something. Exactly. But this is in the process of being done. I mean, if you read, if you go and read Science and Nature, I mean, very, very regularly, at least, in every other issue, there is an article dealing with this precise problem. Yes. Yes, that's right. Absolutely. This is one of the real twists of this problem. So, see, you're dealing with if you take a system of partial differential equations, and you do symmetry reduction, which is variational, and you do symmetry reduction on that system. The reduced system is not necessarily variational. And this is what's happening here. So there is a loss of self-adjointness, formal self-adjointness in the reduction process. Well, no. And you can find conservation laws. In fact, in our proofs, we're using conserved densities. But as you know, there are many systems of partial differential equations which are not variational and which have conservation laws. Because the Einstein equations, have a very, very degenerate symbol. I mean, the one-to-one correspondence between conservation laws and symmetries of variational principles, this works for systems where the symbol is highly non-degenerate. As soon as the symbol becomes degenerate, and this is the case of the Einstein equations where you have a second-order Lagrangian that gives rise to second-order Lagrange equations, you're losing this one-to-one correspondence. These are the so-called abnormal systems. This is the case of abnormal systems in Noether's theory. Of our galaxy, that's right. Yes, the Milky Way, definitely. Definitely. Yes. Very small, actually. It's very, very small. That's right. They're pushed away, exactly. Oh, I don't remember the exact figures, but it's so A and M. Exactly. Very, very small compared to the total mass. Exactly. Oh, that again, it's determined for you so that's going to depend on the initial mass of the star. Yes. Oh, it's of the order of, you're asking a very good question. I don't want to say something stupid, but it's known. But I don't want to give a figure that I don't trust. But it's of a few kilometers. Yes. I mean, for the sun, it's of the order of a few kilometers. Yeah, so my initial theorem doesn't rule out asymptotically periodic solutions, but my second theorem does. Because if they were asymptotically periodic, then the contribution of the Dirac current in some compact region of space would prevail for all time. Because that's that site will be revisited. But what the theorem says is that, I mean, locally uniformly in the size of that contact region, the Dirac current is going to integrate to zero. The integral will be zero asymptotically. So the second theorem, in that sense, is stronger than the first one. But the first theorem is stronger because we look at more general Cauchy data. So we don't know how to handle Cauchy data which are distributional or highly irregular dynamically. And we don't know how to solve that problem. It's an analytical mess. So we do what we can.